I'm Tammy Vindan, your host for Executive with a Cause. Today on the show, I welcome Frances Owusu, founder and CEO of Culture Break. And today we're going to chat about the good, bad, and hard things about running not-for-profits and social enterprises. Frances, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I actually heard about you. Well, no, I've known about you for a while because we've lived in Canberra. Both of us have been in Canberra for a long time. And if you're in the not-for-profit space, it's kind of hard not to know each other.
Yeah, you do cross paths.
You do, one way or another. It's a small city in that respect. But Cindy Reese Mitchell, one of my other guests, had said, you got to get Frances on show.
Can I live up to her expectations? We'll find out.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you will. I'm sure you will. And it's great to finally get to meet you in person because I have seen a lot about what your organization does. But a lot of people who are listening to the show will not know anything about Culture Break. So can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, Culture Break is a charity, not-for-profit organization, and we'll talk a bit more about that later. But our mission really is to empower the well-being of and inclusion of young people through the expression of through the arts. And so our mission is about inclusion, well-being, and again, that sense of purpose, understanding that you are someone.
Mm. So when you talk about the arts, can you go into a little bit more detail about that? Because it's such a broad category.
Yeah, it is. So we primarily focus on dance as the expression. We find that dance is one of those things where it doesn't matter where you're from, you don't have to speak the language, you can come together and celebrate and communicate without words through movement. And so we found that a very great way for young people to express themselves. We get young people coming into our organization who have all sorts of challenges and issues and can't articulate them through words, but through dance is an opportunity to communicate messages and how you're feeling. And so primarily dance, but we do have music as well as another creative outlet.
So let's talk about dance a little bit more because it's an unusual way for a not-for-profit to begin. Did you have a dance background yourself?
Yes, I did. It's just sort of what led me to start Culture Break. I've always loved dance, you know, as a young kid, watching the videos on Video Hits. There was a program called in Australia called Video Hits on MTV, and always seeing like people like Michael Jackson, MC Hammer, all these dancers on that I always used to emulate as a kid. And I came back to Canberra. I got involved at my school with a dance school production called Rockist Effort. And that sort of was the elevation to me taking dance, more regularly. And through that, I was part of forming a boy band that performed for 10 years or so around the country. And we danced. So coming into Culture Break, that was sort of what dance did for me was sort of the expression why it led me to starting Culture Break.
There's a lot of dancers out there, and a lot of them are very focused on their own careers. What was the transition for you that said, you know, I've done this for myself, and now I want to help others? Because that's not something most people think about when they're in the arts necessarily.
Yeah, well, I think that was I reflect on what I gained from the arts and what it did for me. I grew up a very shy kid and very low self-esteem. I remember in school, I used to feel very apprehensive about myself and being in settings, being in crowds, just really that sort of sense that people were looking down at me because I grew up in Geelong as a young child. And there was back in those days, it was an industrial town and migrants weren't, things. So he was this dark-skinned kid family. And so my early schooling years I sort of built this complex that I was somehow not good enough or inferior and that sort of stuff. And when I came into the arts, I got an opportunity to stand on stage and express who I was. And people applauded and people appreciated that and they began to express and begin to provide affirmation as to what I could do. And so I reflect on that and go, the arts gave me that affirmation, that ability to build my self-confidence and esteem. What if it could do that for someone else? And that was the transition. I remember seeing a McDonald's in Sydney. This is really, really, really sort of deep. A McDonald's in Sydney and going to watch a Beyonce concert with my boy band members. And I sat there and I said, I don't want my life to be just about me anymore. And because when you're in a boy band, as you said, you know, I was like, we're going to be a rock star, pop stars, all about us. We're going to make it. And people are going to say how awesome we are. And that was it, that I walked around and go, there's something bigger. There's something more to this than just me. And I came back and I started getting involved in high schools, just giving back my time to kids using dance and out of that birth culture break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people with some great ideas and big hearts for and passion for for doing work in the community, but very few can actually make a living doing that. So, okay, you started volunteering at high schools, what, teaching dance classes?
Yep.
Is that how you did?
Yeah.
And then how did that evolve into like something where you could actually live on it? Because that's the hard part. That's that transition is not very easy.
No, it's not. It's very difficult. And I got to say, you know, I didn't have this sort of, you know, some people have this thing, I'm going to start this organization, I'm going to do this, and it's going to make this, and here's a business plan. Mine was very different. It was organic. I had no idea, when I started, I had no idea where it was going to go. I had no idea that it was going to become an organization. What drove me was, and that passion was, how can I make a difference? How can I make an impact to one life? And by doing that, I started to make a difference. Schools started saying, hey, Francis, can you come to my school? And can you come to my school? And began to ask, you know, how much do we pay you to come? And I started that. So when I first started, I was still working elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
I think for the first 3 years, I had another job. It was something I just did on the weekends. And then it got to this tipping point where I started to realize, okay, it's requiring, well, I'm at another job. I'm getting phone calls and it's requiring my time. I thought, well, I can't keep going both ways, doing the split, so to speak. So then I made that transition and said, right, I'm just going to give my 100%, time to culture break. And I think from that point on, when I first started, you know, I was paying myself next to nothing. So you really do it. So it's the passion, sweat is your payment.
Uh-huh.
But then I started to, as we started to get more and more schools and more people involved, I was able to pay myself something and also pay my team who are helping me to do it something. And it really just built from there. And then it probably working came while I was full-time being paid myself a proper salary where I was actually doing, could live off comfortably at that time, was about 2010.
Okay. So how many years later was that?
That's about 8 years.
8 years.
Mm.
Yeah, but you're a not-for-profit.
Not-for-profit, yeah.
Yeah. Most people, when they start down these pathways, that sounds like a business to me. Mm. How did you turn into a not-for-profit?
So it started, so 2002 started. And people would ask me, I was going to schools helping people and people would ask them, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm just helping our kids. It didn't sound things. So I was like, what am I trying to do? I'm trying to change culture and break negative stereotypes that stop people from being who they are. It's culture break. And I was teaching a bit of breakdance at the time as well. So in the early days, it was culture break. It was playing words, breaking culture, it was breakdance as well. And then I ran into a friend of mine who said to me, you know, this is fantastic, but you really need to set this up properly as a not-for-profit and consider it as a not-for-profit so that you have a structure, because it was just me going into schools and sort of doing, you know, ad hoc stuff. And so in 2005, we set it up as a not-for-profit charity with a deductible gift recipient with ROCO. We did all the structures and that in place in 2005, which then enabled me then to expand and grow because I had an ABN, had structures of which could have board and all that sort of stuff that could actually administrate, yeah, and then gave me the capacity to then go and get grants, go and get people to support. And prior to that was really, we were offering a few classes and charging kids a few dollars to come and take a dance class. Wasn't much at all, $3 at a time and a class. And that was sort of enough to get by, but not enough to build.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, though, that choice was based on a person's suggestion. I think most people today would say, why don't you just set up an ABN with a business attached to it instead of a not-for-profit? Mm. It's actually really complex to do when you have to set up a board of directors and you're the founder. So how do you know they're going to continue in that direction that you set to begin with?
Mm.
What kind of people did you bring in initially into that organization to help you do those things? And how did you manage to maintain that, I guess, sense of identity that you had originally started as a founder when you've already shared that governance with so many other people now?
Mm, that's a very good question. And to some, to be honest, some degree, I don't know how I've done it. The thing, look, the type of people I brought on initially were, I had a friend of mine, his name was Michael. He had business experience and he'd been an entrepreneur himself in the property world and stuff. And so he understood, business structures from an entrepreneurial perspective. He was one that suggested you need to set this up as a, you're doing it for community good, you should set up as a not-for-profit charity. So he spent first 3 years from 2005 to 2008-09 and as a core part of helping me and giving me some business mentoring as well from his own experience. Then I needed, okay, I had that part from, and he was part of our initial board, one of the original board directors. But then I had a whole bunch of young people who were the ones that were going out and teaching the dance. And there's a gentleman, young gentleman now that has become famous that some listeners may recognize and know. His name was Tim O'Matic.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And he came on as a 15-year-old into the organization. And he was so dynamic with his dancing and his ability to, it was well beyond his years at that young age. And he was able to become, to coordinate a crew or posse of, you know, it's almost like the Avengers, you know.
Yeah,
everyone
yeah.
had these breakdance poppers or stuff, and he helped build that. And they were going out with me, but they were really one of the catalysts of helping us to grow. And they would bring a lot of young people getting drawn in because of their flair and expertise and that. So there was that impact was happening on that level. But from a structural level, Michael, I got to say, was probably the earliest, largest sort of single influence in its early days and assisting me because I'm like, I've had a passion for, you know, when you start as a not-for-profit and that you've got passion to help people, uh-huh. you don't necessarily have the business and know-how experience of structures and things. By the way, I do have a banking finance degree, so I do have, came with that bit of understanding from my studies, but there's still a lot of things you don't know. In that space, not-for-profit space. So it was a lot of trial and error in the beginning. How to set up your PYOG, how to set up your get donations, how to all these things where things have just fell into, and then you go, uh-oh, mistake, we've got to do this. and so it was a lot of trial and error in the beginning to do that. But how we stayed, in terms of the live question, how we've stayed true to our governance structure and people have come along. We've had a lot of board members come along. But I think what the key things has been a really, really strong, compelling and passionate mission and vision that has been has really driven this organization that people sometimes may not understand it by on the paper, but once they see it in action and motion, they get it. And I think that's because of the outlet of dance. It's been such a visual thing and the atmosphere it creates. When people come to see it, they go, we understand what this is about.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I think that has really held true. And obviously my continual casting vision has been a big part of that.
Sure. How many employees do you have now?
Okay, we've got about 22 employees.
Oh, wow. Mm. Okay, so you've grown significantly.
We've grown, significantly. And it had to because it got beyond. I got to the point where I go, I can't do this all on my own, you know. And I was doing like 3 or 4 hats, you know. I was teaching 13 classes a week at
wow.
dance, being a CEO, being a business operations manager, doing all these things. I thought, I'm really, really exhausted.
So we've
grown. So we've now got a full-time creative arts manager that looks after our productions and our classes. We have a business operations manager. We have finance. We have administration team. Mm. We have dance coaches that are casuals. And some contractors come with a youth coordinator who coordinates some of our youth programs that we do around mentoring. So we have grown significantly, particularly the last 5 years, as long as it has evolved.
And what kind of funding do you use right now? You know, obviously you do charge for some of your classes
yep.
and you have the school relationships to begin with. What percentage of your services now are funded through individuals versus maybe sponsors or donors?
Yeah, sure. So we have a main source income is fee for service, but we also have government funding. So about 11% of our funding of our annual comes from government funding, and then we have another 15% that comes from partnerships with corporates that give money, but the majority of our operations are fee for service, and so that's what we talk about, the complexities that we realize as a non-for-profit versus a social enterprise, is that we don't primarily rely on funding from government or partners in order to run our operations. And there is quite a large component of a fee-for-service that generates the revenue for the organization.
Yeah. I suspect, though, with your social mission, that not everybody can pay.
No.
So how do you do that balance? If you're so reliant on fee-for-service, how do you support the people that are most likely to be impacted by your mission?
Yeah, that's a good question. How we buy fee-for-service, we are heavily subsidized programs because we want to make sure that everyone gets the ability or the opportunity to be included. And so what that has caused us to do is to not offer like a commercial rate for our program. So, for example, one of our programs, school programs, called Dance Nation, school-based program, where we come into the school and for two terms, 16 weeks, we help the schools create a performance piece to present at the mid-year spectacular, which is coming up next month. In order to do that, we've sought partners to sponsor. So we sponsor a couple of schools where low socio schools don't pay. Mm. So that we've got partners, corporate partners that pay for the entire school to participate. For the rest of the schools that in areas that can offer, payment, we subsidize it by about 60%, so that that enables more young people to participate. Our mentoring programs are free, so that's how we do it. So we raise money to run those things for free, so anyone can come. And then we also give about 220 scholarships for any kid that comes to us that can't pay but wants to participate. We put into a scholarship program. We help sponsor them in a sense to do the program for free. So that's how we kind of do that.
Yeah, so it's heavily subsidized through those other means. Mm. I'm thinking about the mix of kids that you'd have in these classes, obviously from diverse backgrounds. Mm. Do you have people with disabilities also attending?
Yes, we do. Okay. Yeah, we do. So we have quite a number of kids that have high functional autism. Some kids have that Down syndrome that come to our programs, other disabilities. Mm-hmm. And what I found in terms of the environment that we create, it's such an inclusive environment that it says no matter your background, you have a space here for you. And I remember once having a conversation with a parent who had a disabled child, and I felt disappointed in myself that that child wasn't able to have access to more kids who are disabled. And I said to the parent, I said, would you like us to create a class where it's just really primarily focused on kids with disabilities? Mm-hmm. And they said, no, that's the reason why we came to Culture Break, because you don't do that. We want them to have what we call a normal real life experience of different types of people. And that would be detrimental to my child if you provided those services specifically for him. And I thought, wow, I didn't think of it that way. I just thought, well, he's a child. He would benefit if he had like-minded disabled kids living with disability in his group. And they said, necessarily no. It's the environment that we've created that enables him to be himself in that environment is a powerful thing.
And I noticed that with your motto of, actually I can't find it in my notes right now, but it was about you could be yourself there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you don't become somebody, you are somebody.
Yeah. I thought that was quite powerful. With the, I'm just thinking from a funding perspective, you said some of it was government. Do you have NDIS type funding as a result of that?
We do have some clients that come through who choose nominate us as NDIS recipient. We found the whole process for us a bit complex.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
It's very complex. So we haven't yet become an official NDIS provider.
Okay.
But we have some families with us that have nominated us as a recipient. So through NDIS.
Okay.
So this ongoing conversation.
Yeah, so that's the National Disability Insurance Scheme that Australia has for supporting families and individuals that need a little bit of extra help. However, that help is provided, they have more choices. I've done some work with NDIS providers in my own work, and it's complex. Mm. It is really complex in terms of the regulatory requirements for reporting, as an example. So I'd wondered how you would be able to support that properly with the with the number of programs, like when I looked at your website, you had dance classes, Excel dance and music programs, holiday programs, another program called Every Chance to Dance. You had the Elevate Academy, mentoring and leadership with a bunch of programs underneath that. Like I was lost with how it's almost like a full school system in itself.
Yeah. It has kind of organically, it's one of those things you say that, organically morphed into all these separate things. And I think what the interesting thing in the learning, there's learnings of that. What that's created is every time we found a need, we created a program to support that need. And I think we've got to the point of from our capacity going, we have got so many programs that we're going, we're now at the point where we're going, what are the ones that we need to focus on delivering going forward? And we're now going through a process now of reviewing some of our programs that have been there. Some of them have been quite a long time. And they're so, our heartstrings, we've got young people who are really dedicated and want these programs going, but we're at the point where we go, how do we sustain sustainability long-term for some of these services that we've, that have organically just started and become part of the fabric of this organization? So it is a challenge that we are looking at. And I think one thing that I've sort of learned, and I sort of encourage others in the space when they're looking for funding, for government funding, is don't chase the funding. Focus on what your core purpose is. Because what happens is sometimes you can get lulled in the sense of creating a program to get the funding,
yeah,
which then creates, so you have these things that you're chasing to do these things, but how does it really align with your core purpose and mission?
I think that is really good advice. The capacity to serve is a common problem with so many organizations. When the need is so broad, how do you put your resources in the places that would make the most difference, right? And I think that is such good advice because a lot of people chase the grants, but they're only one year funding.
Yeah.
And so how do you make that sustainable? For the programs that you have in place right now, like there's this whole aspect of dance, but how do you actually make that more of the social mission other than allowing anybody and their brother to come into these classes, regardless of capability and financial capacity to pay for it? How else do you really embrace that mission of yours to make it inclusive?
Mm. Yeah, that's a very good question too. I think the answer I'd provide to that one is the key is belonging. People ask us, what is Culture Break selling? And I say, if we were selling a product, you know, in a store, it would be belong, a place to belong. And we notice that is probably one of the biggest things for young people, a sense of identity and belonging that you, who you are is someone. And the fact that we use dance is just a tool, an outlet, a doorway to the core thing, which is, belonging and a self-expression. And I liken it to a young child. You know, when you sort of meet a young child who you don't know and you go into the house and you see the young, oh, she's so cute, he's so cute. And he's like, and they're sort of a little shy and sort of thing. They want to come to you and stuff, blah, blah, blah. And then while you're talking to the parent or the people, they say, look what I can do. And they show you this thing and then that thing. And then you go, wow, that's fantastic. You can do that. Or here's what I made. And as you begin to go, oh, that's awesome, they get this sense of validation. And then they feel I belong in this conversation. And then they go and express themselves. And next, you know, they're like, hey, come here, come and look at my play toy, come and look at this. And it's that thing that I talk about is when you create a space where young people can come in, and we just use dance as a tool, but it could be surfing, it could be anything, it could be knitting, whatever you choose. But the primary driver is a space where they can belong and be themselves, whether they have to do something in order to be someone. That is really what we're creating here. And that is what's the essence of what's in this world where young people are, you know, social media these days, where they're having to like keep up with, you know, doing something, you know, how many followers you have, if I'm be popular. So at our Culture Break, we say, you don't have to do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Just come as you are.
I think that organizations that do that really well often have rituals to bring that sense of belonging and even, you know, nicknames and ways that they do things that are unique. Do you have any rituals or anything so that people feel like they're part of the tribe?
Yeah, we call this the culture, the KB vibe.
Ah.
You know, one of the things is KB vibe. And one of the things, one of the rituals is celebration. We want to celebrate you. And some of the practical things we do is when they come to a program, we have like a jam circle. So they might learn some moves and then we get around the circle and we just clap and they cheer and everyone goes and does anything they want to do. And that's sort of a sense of celebration that we just celebrate you. So that's probably one of the biggest rituals we do. And you see, if you come to our productions, in the very production, we always do what we call a jam. That's how we finish it. Everyone gets a chance to show who they are individually, as well as the opportunity in the performance to show who they are collectively. So that'll be one of the big ones that we do. We celebrate. It's a celebration that we just enable people to just express themselves as they are.
I think the sense of belonging is a need even adults need, right? You need to feel like someone's going to miss you if you don't show up. And having a safe place for people of any background, children of any background, that they can go to and feel safe. That they won't be judged and that they can, you know, express themselves physically. I think that's such a powerful mission that is not obvious on the surface. You know, if I go to your website, it looks like you're just another dance class almost.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of options for kids to do that.
Yeah, there is. And I think that's one of the tensions we've had. And we just did a rebrand in 2020, I think 2 years ago. Do a full rebrand, and we got a branding agency to come and look at a rebrand. And one of the tensions has been the organization is that on the outside, people go, oh, they're just offering dance classes, a hobby. My kids can go along and have fun. And then they come and see where they go, oh, it's a lot more than that. And one of the tensions that we've struggled and challenged with in the organization is how do we continue to provide that outlet, but yet really drive the mission and impact. And one of the things we decided to do, we thought we needed to do, was to get some evidence-based research in that. So in 2020, we engaged Western Sydney University to come and do an evidence-based research around to validate what we are doing and to really tease out and bring out what is it that is it that we are about, what is our core mission, what impact are we actually making, and how would you measure that? And so that gave us an opportunity the last 12 months. That just finished September last year. Produce a document which we can communicate with government agencies, with corporates, and say, here's a piece of work that's now been validated independently that confirms that the culture break is more than just the dance. And this is how, and these are the 10 key findings that is now shows that culture break goes beyond the idea of dance. I think what you're saying is a very, very valid observation, because I still get that quite a bit.
So what are some of the KPIs that you can use to measure impact?
One of them was belonging. The other one was social connectedness.
Yeah.
How socially connected they are.
Yeah.
How their ability to express themselves, self-confidence. And then the other thing was about self-agency. How are they using what they've been given to be able to make a difference elsewhere in their lives? How does that translate? How does that empower them to be able to go from, say, taking a dance class or being part of the organization to feeling confident to go for a job, to feeling confident to go through their academic, let's be at school to get the tools. So there's some of the challenges. Some of the other findings were around what we've discovered now is that because we've sort of evolved more into the mental health and well-being space, is the training aspect. How do we train our young people and get skills and capabilities and to train to be able to deliver services, support in the mental health and well-being space? So that's one of the other challenges and sort of recommendations that came out of this report last year, is more have a focus on the training aspect of existing team members, because a lot of our young people are young, come to our organization, and they themselves are developing and sort of trying to understand who they are and have their own challenges, and how do we equip them to be able to deal with potentially peers that may be only a few years younger than them in our mission.
I think one of the challenges that really every charity has is how do you measure that social impact? And, you know, you talk about some really qualitative measures that are very hard to put numbers behind, right? So you talk about belonging, you talk about self-esteem and things like that. How do you measure that?
That's a tough one. That's always a tough one. And I think that's the thing, you know, which is different. Like when we always call and say, like when we go ask for, if you're running something for cancer, you know, we call it the sexy charities, the sexy ones, because it's always, because everyone knows, you know, unfortunately everyone knows someone who's impacted and knows the devastation impacts of cancer or diabetes or anything like that. But how do you go to someone and say that sense of, you know, that sense of belonging? You know, it's hard, very difficult to measure. And it takes years. It's not in years for that to be rolled out. And it's funny, it's only, I find that usually 5 to 10 years later, we get feedback from the young person who's now, I had one last week, name was Dom, and he's now 27. And he said, at 27, he's telling the story of how the impact back when he was 15. Now he sees, now we're getting it. So it's a long thing. So at the time, it's very difficult to measure what sense of belonging. But what we are doing, we've got some surveys and things that we give the kids in terms of our programs. Do you feel included? Do you feel a sense of agency and voice in our programs? Yeah. And measure those sort of anecdotal things in the class to give us feedback that we're on track, that they feel a sense of belonging. Are they turning up every week? Gives us a sense of, well, if they want to come every week, well, it's because they have this sense of belonging.
Yeah.
So those are things we can measure.
Yeah.
But the long-term difference is difficult.
Yeah.
So difficult.
Every charity has the same issues, right? It is, I mean, it's one thing to say you're fighting cancer and be able to see some medical results from the research or something like that. I think it's another thing to say you're trying to make a social difference and can you really measure it? It's so hard.
It is so hard.
Especially when it's a long-term investment in kids, that, like you said, you can't see that return for a while.
Yeah.
Can you see a difference like in their attendance in schools or their grades? Or
yeah, we've seen many stories where a young man, he's dyslexic, and he said he was struggling in school, and so he wasn't concentrating in class, and the teacher then thought his behavioral problems because he couldn't concentrate. The fact is he had difficulty learning and it affected his self-esteem. He came to Culture Break. He's still with us. And that turned around when he was able to dance and express himself. And we interviewed him. He recounted that it was the dance that his grades went from C and D to A and B student. And we're like, wow. And I said, what was the difference? He said, was that I got that confidence to express myself in a positive way. Well, I got validation and affirmation of who I was that gave me the confidence to translate into my academia. So I was like, okay.
Yeah. I think you have a huge benefit of the way that you deliver your services. It is such a visual way of showing that. Like, not every organization can take great videos or pictures of what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, if nothing else, to protect the people are caring for, right? Mm. So for you to be able to share these concerts and performances, I suppose, it's a great way to showcase what you're actually achieving. We talked briefly before the show about some of the things that you're working on, though, that are for the future. Mm. And even about this whole decision around, are you a social enterprise or are you a not-for-profit? I mean, by legal standards, you are a charity. So, you know, that's very clear. But the way that you deliver the services, oftentimes the people that are in charities, they're creating income one way to service a separate population. Mm. And yet you are creating income sometimes, or at least part of the time, through the same people that you're servicing. So it's a different business model altogether for what you do. What kind of plans do you have for the future?
Yeah, that's a good question too. Yeah, that's a lot of good questions. Very good interviewer. What are plans for the future? Well, I guess there's three things that we want to try and do. One is sustainability. And I think the last 2 years of COVID has really taught us something about sustainability. Mm. Because we operated in schools in the last 2 years, we saw schools shut down and that we weren't able to get revenue because we couldn't run programs. Mm. We couldn't run programs after school. And so we need to look at how we diversify ourselves and consolidate our core areas, hence why we that person reviewing how do we scale what we're doing and how do we become sustainable. So I think one of the things is financial stability. And one of the things we're doing with is to do that is to consolidate some of the programs that are doing extremely well and see how we can replicate those and scale those ones up. So we have one of our programs called Dance Nation that runs for half the year. How can we scale it up to run the full year? We are looking at other things like we talk about training employment area. So we started a pathway into training employment and looking as we're coming out of COVID, there are the opportunities there and government's looking to provide young people with pathways to employment. So we are investigating those lines and we've started run pilots with the ACT Education Director last year.
Is this in the arts itself?
That's specific in the arts. Uh-huh. The one we're in the process with the ACT government and the tender process at the moment is to take a step further. It's going beyond the arts. It's going into hospitality. It's going into real estate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's stepping out even further. And it's all about equipping the young people with the skills and the confidence so they can feel more confident to be able to go into employment. So there's the thing. So we're taking that, we're looking at that for future for sustainability, how to diversify our income base. So we're not relying on one source of income. And it, I think it's too, is how do we attract the right people, continue to attract the right people to be able to carry the mission of the organization. So there's a component of going forward, how do we better train our existing members? How do we attract a value proposition that attracts people to bring those skill sets that we need and right across from the board all the way down to a more skills-based board, getting each level of the organization attracting. So as we are growing sustainable, we've got the right people in the organization to be able to sustain the growth long term.
That's a problem for every organization, for profit or not. You know, like it's especially in this time and place where wages have gone up dramatically in the last couple of years, along with COVID.
Yep.
The arts programs in particular have been hit drastically. And so being a charity and an arts provider, like that's
enormous
a double.
Problems. It
right?
is a double whammy.
I noticed though that you did add a Every Chance to Dance program, which is an online capability for any kind of school anywhere, right? That took you outside of Canberra. Mm. Where they can go ahead and sign up their school to have online programs for dancing. How did that go?
Yeah, that's been good. That's been going for the last since 2014,
15. Oh, so you've had it for a while
You've had it a while,
okay.
And that enabled us, what I found, this is part of the teething problems when I really need a bigger team, is that at the time, everybody wanted me to come to the school. And I found and I could go to so many schools at the time. I thought, I need to work a way how I can duplicate myself. Or you can online, right?
Yeah.
So I created this online resource. It took me 4 years to create it. It's just like a year. I can teach online for a year, term by term, week by week, for all. It's primary school based, from kindy all to year six. And during COVID, it enabled us to was really good because schools could still access, and it's schools around the country, in particular Victoria, who were in lockdown for a lot longer than most other states and territories, we had teachers reaching out to us using our resource because how do we support kids at home? So it was great to be able to have an outlet to be able to have Culture Break, one of the Culture Break's programs that we'd created in that environment. So that's gone quite well. And it's been well received. We've gone to New Zealand, schools in New Zealand using it. And we've had interest in UK and US as well about this resource. But
timing was excellent on that one.
Yeah. I had no idea what that was going to happen.
When you talk about expanding your services beyond dance, does that feel like you're breaking your mission at all?
Not at all, because I think when you look at our mission, it's about it's coming back to the individual. It's about empowerment. It's about transformation of the individual. And I think that's like I sort of alluded to earlier, it could have been surfing. It could have been anything. We just use that as a tool because we see dance as very culturally contemporary to young people. People love dancing or music. Mm. Could be music as well, but I didn't choose dance. But is what the interests are of the young people, what brings them together, what's culturally accepted and embraced, and then bringing them in and go, okay, you like to do this, but really here, what we really want here is to see that you're okay. You experience transformation. you find a place where you can express yourself.
Yeah.
And so that good thing about that enables us to be able to pivot and steer to some degree. Mm. If we wanted to, if for some reason that no one wants to dance anymore, it would change our model, what we could offer, but it would also provide new opportunities to carry the same heart and purpose of the organization in another area. Hence why the training employment thing fits the model, because it's the same philosophy about supporting individuals to have that sense of empowerment, that they can have the school, the tool sets they need to win in life,
yeah,
so to speak.
And I guess your stakeholder or your students are growing up in the program, so they have different changing needs as well.
They do.
So you're still supporting them, but in different ways. It's really interesting how broadly you're looking at that mission, because I think if on the outside looking in, I don't think I could have seen that. I couldn't have seen that your mission is much more broad, but because you define it that way as their leader, you are seeing opportunities that wouldn't be available otherwise.
Mm.
So, you know, I think that's a really good lesson for a lot of other organizations to be careful of how they define their mission.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that's, I think that's that too. And also too, how you express it through the organization. And because one of the challenges the lessons we learned, I thought when I first started, I got a big vision, I got a big heart, I got to want to change the world. Like we all start that, you know, mm-hmm. thing. And I realized, got the point, that there was nothing, the mission and the vision wasn't an issue. It was the people you have on the bus.
Yeah.
You got to make sure you have the right people on the bus, or you're going to have this constant tension between you're seeing it this way, but they're seeing it another way. And I think that's one of the lessons we learned in the end of 2016 and the last 5 years. We've seen a dramatic shift and change in our organization's trajectory. And we've literally, if you look at our balance sheets from there in the last 5 years, it's almost chalk and cheese. People ask them, what changed? And I said, what changed? Is I came to that realization, two things. One, me as a leader needed to grow. So it's about me, you know, mm-hmm. you can only go as far as the organization as a leader and person, founders of organizations can only grow as far as they've grown. Mm-hmm. And so I need to evolve, number one, self-reflection, self-think. And then the second part was, who do I have on the bus, so to speak? And that was a term someone told me, so I've sort of stolen it. But so you got to have the right people on the bus. Who do I have on the bus? Because once you get the right people on the bus, you can then drive where we need to go. But if you don't, then there's going to be tension. People want to get off at different spots,
yeah.
Come on for different reasons. So that was
And everybody has a different part of that journey with you,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You alluded to the fact that you're looking for more people on the bus or different kind of people on that bus. Who are you looking for right now? Maybe we can help you with your recruitment.
Yeah,
at the
look, I think one of the things that be from top level, from our board level, I think we've got some really strong people around governance. I think the area that we do lack in is how do we speak to government more clearly, given the fact that we've traditionally not had high involvement in terms of funding from government, and we don't become government funding dependent. But we want to be able to engage and have that sort of thing. So people who have that may have around tenders, grants, working with government would be a great addition from a board level. I think from organisation level, I think I think the critical skill that I think is missing, not just in our organisation, but I think broadly, is a critical thinking skill.
Mm.
Is ability to look at a problem and to be able to dissect it and come up with solutions. And I kind of like call it a detach-retach technique, is to be able to look at a problem, detach yourself from it,
mm-hmm.
look at it as a team, analyze it, then reattach the solutions and the mission, with the action plan and the going. Because often the danger is that you remain attached to the people who are in those, and then what happens often, you end up warring with each other or tension with the people. Really, that's not the issue. It's this thing that you want to fix, right? And I think that's one of the challenges of the organization, is how do you get more and more people who have those soft skills, ability to critically think, ability to collaborate. It's about how do I bring people on the journey? How do I, with my team, how do I know, coach, and know, or support them in the way that they shine, they excel, finding what moves and drives them. I think more and more people that you can attract in the organization that possess those skills, empathy is probably a massive one, how to be an empathetic leader. And to be able to come here, go, not beat your own chest. This is how I do it. It's going to be my way, highway. But how do I bring people along the journey?
You just mentioned both soft and hard skills there. And I think the not-for-profit sector is full of people that have very large hearts. And oftentimes you could find that they have that empathetic, passionate view of things. But going back to the harder skill of problem solving and critical thinking, that's harder to find anywhere, really.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
Yeah, it is.
Like, it's not hard to find the softer side in not-for-profit world. In business world, it's different.
Yeah.
But in the not-for-profit sector, I think people legitimately come to work in these organizations because they care about the mission.
Yeah.
And that's what drives them, right?
Yeah.
Those harder skills, even at the board level, is sometimes missing.
Yeah.
To provide that strategic paintbrush that you can lay out the budget and operating model around. It's difficult.
Yeah.
It is very difficult. And I don't have a solution for that.
I was going to say, if you have a solution, I'm on bated breath right now. I'm going, that's the solution. Give me the answer.
Yeah, I don't have a good solution for that. That's one reason why a lot of organizations that can afford it will bring in outside consultants to
constantly
just to provide sometimes they're actually saying the same thing that your own folks are saying, but it's actually just confirming that.
Mm.
And you don't trust your voice anymore because you have been in it too long and in your team as well, that you can't tell if that's actually good advice. And sometimes that third party is what you really need, whether they provide a pro bono or if they can afford it by a fee.
Yeah.
The reality is that that's one reason why people think about outsiders.
Yeah.
It's just to say, we think this is the right direction, but I can't see it anymore.
Mm.
You know, and it's time to get a third perspective. Yeah. Sometimes you need to pay for it sometimes.
Yeah, and that's very useful advice. And I think that's something that, if your organization is in a position to do that, something to consider. And that's something we're looking at too as well. And we've started, we're looking at a piece right now, how to improve our communication protocols. And so we're going to do a third party facilitate that because we think we know how to communicate. You know, we just do this and this. And it's like sometimes you need a third party to help you facilitate and sometimes confirm what you're saying, what you already know.
Yeah.
Or can say it in a different way that makes sense to those, makes sense to everybody to go in that direction.
Yeah. It's hard though, you know, when you have limited budget, last thing you want to do is, especially if you can't find a pro bono person that's good enough for what you need, to have to pay that fee is like, but it could save you 12 months.
It could
save you 24 months, you know? Yeah. So sometimes it's looking at it from a return on investment. It could be time as well.
Yeah.
Well, I know you have a lot going on right now. If people want to find out more about you, or maybe they know someone who might be ideal for your bus.
Get on board.
what's the best way to know more about Culture Break and to reach out to you?
Yeah, you can find us online, just, culturebreakwithak.com. So type in that and you can find out who we are, what we do, and how to get involved. So that's probably the first place I'd say to look at. And obviously we've got social media handles. We're on Facebook and also LinkedIn and Instagram. And
can we come out to one of your performances?
Yes, you can. We've got end of next month, we have two big performances at the Convention Center on the 30th of June. It's our Dance Nation program, a school-based program where we get 500 kids from all the schools come and they perform. Our theme this year is Unite, and so they're just expressing that through dance. And then we have our community-based program called this year's Rewind, and that's on the 26th of June, so very close together. So if you want to find out how you want to come along to that, you can purchase tickets. Or if you really want to come, you can't afford, contact us and we'll find a way. Always is a way.
Okay. We'll try to get this show out before then to make sure people can hear more about those events before they come. So Francis, thank you for your time today. It's been wonderful learning more about Culture Break and all the work that you guys do. I really think it's a charity that's under recognized for the social mission, and being able to just share that now and to understand more about what you guys do to really help our young people and help them with their belonging and letting them know that there is a place for them. There is a place where people will miss them if they're not there, that that's really important right now in our society. So thank you for the work that you and your team do.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcasts, I'm helping not-for-profits with IT decisions. The question for this week's IT in Plain English segment came from a client. The question is, what's the difference between a digital transformation and an IT transformation? Now, this is actually a really tough question because if you look these terms up, you'll find many, many different definitions, including some that will completely conflict. This is why these terms are so confusing to you as well. And quite honestly, many experts tend to use the word digital for everything these days because it's currently in vogue. Now, I'm going to give you my definition, which I hope provides a little clarity, but it may not be the right Wikipedia answer for you. For a digital transformation, it tends to be more externally focused in a way that you interact with your stakeholders, whether it's a donor, member, or someone you're even delivering services to. And specifically, that's delivering through the internet. For IT transformation, it tends to be more internally focused to fix underlying risk and system issues. However, it could also have digital elements which will improve your team's processes too. Now, in reality, does the terminology even matter? No, it really doesn't. When I do a transformation for a client, I usually let them decide because at the end of the day, they're the ones that have to communicate it to both their internal and their external stakeholders. And if those words have a specific meaning that will help them gain buy-in, I'm all for it. So there you have it in plain English. If you have an IT question you want me to answer, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a message. I just might answer it on the show. And if you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave me a review. To all you executives with the cause, the world is definitely a better place because of you. Thank you for what you and your teams do every day. Cheers.